You're listening to the Seasteading Today podcast, where we speak to entrepreneurs and researchers who are making the dream of seasteading a reality. The Seasteading Today podcast. Stop arguing and start seasteading.
Hello, listeners. I just wanted to let you know that this interview was recorded in February of 2020, before the death of George Floyd in police custody ignited protests around the nation. If you want to hear Dale Brown's perspective on the culture of policing, you can find a link to a more recent interview on our show notes page. Today, I'm very excited to have Dale Brown of the Detroit Threat Management Center to discuss how to keep seasteading communities safe. Dale's organization specializes in stopping violence through nonviolent strategies and tactics designed to create a nonviolent outcome. Welcome, Dale.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah, so we met up again at Anarchapoco last week, and it was probably my second or third time seeing you give a presentation. So I was just so thrilled when you mentioned seasteading in your presentation, and then we had some good conversations after that. So I'm glad that you could be on the podcast and we can share what we talked about at the conference with the podcast audience.
Yes.
So to start, can you give us a brief history of how you launched the Threat Management Center in Detroit?
Yes. The way that I started my organization was simply by thinking about what is it that we need to be safe as regular people so that we can have a good quality of life. And what came to mind first was our own personal responsibility for creating safety by focusing on how to teach people how to defend themselves, their families, their communities, and their corporations using the necessary and required skills and understanding of both psychology, law, and actual tactics. So I blended them together to create one system, an urban survival tactics training system, which I call the Eclectican Survival System. And then I use this training system to train both civilians, regular people, members of the public, and police officers on how specifically not to use violence to create non-adversarial interactions and have non-violent outcomes. So this is a true paradigm shift in the way in which societies and the people that live in them view the use of violence and the solutions to avoid the use of violence to create a better place for everyone to live. And that's why I think it's great for seasteading. So this is what I've done for 25 years in Detroit. We've been able to make things safe for families. We made it so that rich people became richer because when they don't have violence on their property, they are more successful. And we found that we take accountability and responsibility as people, and we don't try to depend on others to provide for us. We can actually provide better because we, as the people, can provide better for the people than anyone else because you have a personal responsibility and accountability to outcome. So each and every one of us is our own bodyguard, and our training system specifically gives you that ability to protect yourself and do so in the least inappropriate ways possible. So in other words, you learn how to create positive outcomes, and from that positive outcome is a peaceful and prosperous outcome.
Yeah, I love that. I wonder if some folks are making the connection between nonviolent. I mean, I guess, could you explain a bit more? Is it our instinct to rely on violence? Is that something that people have to overcome when you're training and teaching them your tactics and your method?
Absolutely. Your question is a very valid point. Is it natural for us to be violent? And the truth is, of course, absolutely. We as people, even when we don't intend to, are absolutely violent. It's a tool for us, a primal tool. And that tool is instrumental in everything that we do. So whether it's interacting in business, interacting in our families, interacting in societal structural issues, violence is the go-to mechanism or tool for humans when we lack necessary knowledge to avoid it. And I mean the necessary knowledge being something different than our feelings. So when we feel fear, there's a natural relationship between a fear-based response and a negative violent outcome. So that's what threat management's about. It's about teaching people how to manage threats, specifically how to understand psychology so you can control yourself and understand what you're experiencing and then create a non-adversarial interaction for a non-violent outcome, which can only happen if we learn how to manage threats properly, whether it's internally in our family or within ourselves or externally from strangers. We have to understand how humans interact, how to understand human body language, which we call protective praxeology, how to use protective proxemics to create the actual nonviolent outcome. And so if you think about it, college kids go to college every year, and every year just playing around, accidentally kill each other in hazing incidents. That's how easy it is to kill people. You don't even have to intend to. You can literally say, I'm a person of peace, and end up killing a friend just playing around. So imagine if you understood and you were trained not to kill people, not to create conditions where people can accidentally be killed. And this happens both in the public arena as well as the military and law enforcement. There are accidental deaths that are avoidable, that are based upon fear and ignorance of a condition or situation. And that's what threat management's here to do, is to bridge that gap so that people are enabled with the ability to create the positive they're looking to create by understanding things they normally wouldn't understand. And we broke it down into simple ways that you can use this information as a regular person to protect yourself and your family and your community and your corporation if you own a business or you're at work. And so that, you know, at the end of the day, we're able to manage our own threats as an individual and maintain freedom, liberty, and a good quality of life without resorting to violence, as long as we have the tools that allow us to do that.
That's great. So it sounds like when I'm thinking about creating a seasteading community, I need that commitment from the other folks who are going to be in that community. And I'm really curious about how you can apply psychology. And you do talk in your presentations about observing body language, but when you're on floating homes out of several miles from the coast, how do you begin to think about identifying threats or like setting up the community to identify threats using those methods of looking at psychology and body language?
So the first threat to any individual, family, group, community, society is the internal threats. The internal threats, yourself, starting with yourself. If you have fear of water, for example, you will not be a good seasteader. You cannot be a good a good person on a pod if you're terrified of the water that surrounds it. So the first thing we have to do is teach you how to manage the fear of water. So if you couldn't swim, you need to learn how to swim. And then you need to have different devices that enable you to swim even better should you have a water-related situation or need to get in the water or need to use the water to vacate the area or to simply go fishing. So we want to make sure that, you know, you're enabled to overcome fear of water and fear of the fish in the water and those kinds of things if we're going to have you manage your quality of life there. And that's just part of one aspect of it. But the other part of it is, how do we manage each other in terms of creating a community culture that embodies the overall purpose and objectives of that community? And where I come in to this is this. I work with communities, homeowner associations, individuals and communities. And for 20 years now, 25 years, I've been specifically dealing with people, living with people, around people, near people, very rich people and very poor people. So I have a chance to see how different people act under different conditions, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, from arguing from everything from noise to dating issues to land disputes. And I got a chance to address these issues personally for 25 years, and I'm accountable for outcome. So that's why I care so much. And that's why I think that the things I'm going to share with the seasteading community is so important, because what I'm bringing to the table is a higher level of understanding of community and the culture of the collective required to have a cohesive, collaborative community that can address issues in a calm and appropriate, peaceful manner. And without the knowledge that I have, it'll be very challenging to do so, simply because there's a lot of things we wouldn't normally know, which I did not know. For example, I did not know that people get very upset about noise and spatial issues, and those things need to be addressed in the agreement, you know, between the seasteader and the community before they join, as well as how and which ways that there will be remedy in the event that there is some type of violation or structural division from the actual rules of the community. So those things are very important in terms of how you get along with each other, and to creating a good quality of life in a seasteading community will require a lot of, you know, collective community cohesion.
That you made me laugh when you talked about needing to learn how to swim, and it also, you really articulated something that I experienced. So almost a year ago, I went to Thailand as one of the first seasteading certification. It was a test run of doing these a seasteader certification program, which included scuba diving and sailing. And it was it's been very hard for me to articulate why those skills are necessary. But what it did teach me was some safety protocols. You know, when you're diving, the first thing they teach you is if you're in trouble, here are the hand signals that people can see from a distance, whether you're underwater or on the surface. And so that just clarified it so well that, you know, even if you're not going to be scuba diving every day, knowing those protocols when you're around people who are sailing and diving and have this long culture of maritime practices and can signal your if you're in distress, it did give me a lot more confidence in the water just to understand those. So,
you won't even need to get in the water if you don't want to. There's ways that we can devise it so that there's drone technologies, there's rescue drones, there's things you can throw to people. So it's not like you have to be this aquatic person to be in a pod, but to understand the water is vital. So you lose your fear of it. And as well as, you know, having remedy for different levels and types of issues. So we'll be looking at, you know, how you can use, you know, sound in the water to get rid of certain aquatic creatures if you wanted them to, you know, leave the area, such as a shark or something. Or if you wanted to repel a person from the area, there's ways to use lights and sounds. So you don't have to focus on, you know, again, force, violence, aggression, or fear. You can have the actual methods already designed intrinsically into the membership in the pod community that teaches you how to manage these different issues so you don't have conflict and situations that are challenging to your quality of life.
Right. And so your comments about community are fascinating. I'm curious to see how things will change on the water, because on the land, we're used to thinking about if I put a fence up, then that first designates my space, not your space, and then can also block sound. But those things won't work on the water. We'll have to think up new tools to use for, like, sound carries farther on the water. So if you want to play music, you might affect your neighbors differently. And you can't necessarily block people from coming into your space because water doesn't allow you to set those barriers.
Right. Exactly. Very good point. And so there's going to have to be a lot of, you know, communal cohesive support and understanding as it relates to, you know, assisting each other as well in the time of need. There needs to be, you know, established protocols and procedures for assisting with people that need everything from, you know, just assistance in general with general issues to an actual emergency condition. So those are things we're going to be talking about in the future, and that, you know, will be instrumental in helping with establishing intelligent, comprehensive, but simplistic and practical protocols and procedures for managing threats. And we call it managing threats because we really don't need to have fear of threat. We don't need to have fear at all. We need to have management of any threat condition, because one threat condition actually is actually a chain reaction to other threat conditions. So for example, when a person is drowning in the water, even if you're a good swimmer, if you don't understand how to rescue someone, you will actually be killed by the person who is actually drowning. Mm-hmm. And so that happens commonly. In some cases, 2, 3, 4 people are dead, even though they were really good swimmers. just because one person panicked or one person wasn't as good and resulted in the death of many others. So that is a result of a lack of training for that condition, which would require you to either A, know how to put someone into a rescue position and take them from behind and remove them from the water, or B, using a throwable to throw to them and just pull them in. So you're not exposed to the water, causing yourself to possibly get pulled under. So little simple things make a big difference and make so people can manage their fear and maintain a sense of good feeling and good quality of life while they're on the water in their pod.
Right. So I do want to talk more at some point, you know, those things that from your experience you determine will be the more common threats that we should consider. But I would like to go through some of the most obvious questions that we get on a regular basis, like how would you deal with pirates?
Yes.
So how do we prepare for that? Yeah.
So the way you deal with pirates, number one, is have a threat manager on site. So I would definitely suggest you physically have a designated threat management pod already built in. And that's where we would man that facility. We'd always have someone there. And then people specifically trained to defend themselves, of course. That's something we would do while we're there as well, is train the individuals to protect themselves and their pod. But you need to have someone designated as the protector of the community. And the individuals of the community need to also be protecting themselves, because safety is number one. Without safety, there is nothing. And so protection is safety. Safety is not something that happens for us. It happens by us. And so we create the safety we need. In the situation where you are isolated, you are in a remote location, you would definitely have to have already in place all of your safety requirements. So one of the things that you and I spoke about in Acapulco was about the need for pod intrinsic safety engineering built into each pod. So I'll be looking at different ways we can make it more difficult for anyone to enter the pod, for anyone to scale the outside of the pod using a boat and a ladder. I love the design of the pods already. The ones I saw are excellent. It'll be very difficult for someone to enter this type of pod. And we're going to make it even safer with some of the recommendations we have. And there's lots of options that have nothing to do with, you know, weapons that can injure and kill people. But there's lots of non-lethal technologies, pepper spray, rubber rounds that can be fired, smoke, things that can be used to distract, disrupt, and deter, detect, and defend the pods and the community from any incursions by pirates and any individuals that would have any negative intentions. And it's imperative to understand that they will be drawn to, specifically to the pods, as the pods are beautiful, and they'll automatically be attractive to the predator-type people. But as long as they know that you have protection on site, they will not come there. And we will be encouraging that through how threat management interacts with the community and the society around the area. They'll know it's a protected community, which is what we do here in Detroit. And that's why we don't have problems. We have no fighting, no injuries, no deaths in the communities when we're protecting the communities, because we made the criminals believe it's a protected community. And you do that first and foremost by using psychology, understanding law, and then having the skills to create the safety required for, in our case, 5,000 families here in the Detroit area, 5,000 residences, and approximately 100 businesses.
So on the law side of it, you know, I'm only barely starting to learn the intricacies of maritime law. So that's how would you begin to start to interpret maritime law in a community with the goal is to be out beyond territorial waters of any one nation?
Correct. And that's why you need to understand not just maritime law, but how the laws of whatever the local area would be. So for example, if there is a actual criminal activity, the closest land-based contact that you have would then be the jurisdiction that would take into consideration the acts and then adjudicate the conditions. So if there was a rape, a robbery, a shooting, or someone claims to be, whether it's true or not, then what would happen is whatever the closest landmass is, that's the one that would generally adjudicate the situation. And then you need to know those laws pursuant to there. But what we do is we make sure we're so abundantly clear and concise in our defensive posture and what we teach that it's legal everywhere. The way we do things is completely legal everywhere. And that's, we specifically design it that way. So there's no way someone could say what you did to defend yourself, your family, your community, your corporation is illegal or overstepping boundaries. So we take it a step further and making sure that we always create a buffer, a legal buffer, so that no one can ever interfere with you, or at least you can reduce the exposure you would have in a criminal or civil related situation, even in maritime situations.
Right. Oh, okay, great. So that leads to my next question. By communicating clearly that this is a protected community, I see law enforcement doing what critics call security theater, where they're presenting a very big stick, but it's not necessarily making people safe. So what's the difference between communicating that this community is secure and security theater?
Perception by the predatory element. So if the predators are not convinced, they will attack. If the predators are, they will not. Your job is to make sure that you are perceived the way you want to be perceived and your community is. And if they don't perceive you properly, then there's going to be an incursion. That incursion will involve whatever, you have put into place. So if you put into place nothing, but just theater, then at that point, the predators will figure that out as they approach and actually breach the theatrical lines actually prey upon the people. And if you actually have, some degree of protection, you'll have to use it because they'll actually try something. So if you do things properly, though, psychologically, you're not going to ever have that issue. So, for example, since 1998, we've been protecting a cigarette company that's a $350 million company. It was a $250 million company when we started. And the only reason they can still deliver their products in Detroit is because we stopped their hijackings. So the state tried to stop the hijackings. The federal government tried to stop the hijackings. Local counties and city police tried to stop the hijackings. These hijackings could not be stopped. And apparently, these hijackings have been going on in Detroit since before Beverly Hills Cop 1, where Eddie Murphy was hanging out of the back of a cigarette truck. It's apparently since the 20s. And we stopped it by creating the conditions for the criminal element to believe that this is just a well-protected truck. Now, we're doing this unarmed. So we can be armed. We can carry guns if we want to. We just don't need to. Our uniform, our equipment, our methods of communicating with people are designed specifically to create non-adversarial interactions and non-violent outcomes. And if you do what we do and try to protect, but you don't follow our procedures, you can actually create conflict at liquor stores, gas stations, grocery stores, just because you didn't know how to interact with people properly. We also interact with police officers in every community surrounding Detroit as well as Detroit and have no conflict with them as well. So when I say we've been doing this for over 20 years, we've been doing anti-hijacking for over 20 years successfully in the inner city, protecting millions of dollars in cargo and cash. There's actually cash on the trucks and we don't carry a gun protecting the cash in Detroit successfully for over 20 years. We've also been responding to home alarms, responding to business alarms, and we used to carry. We just stopped in 2017, and we stopped because I had a realization that we just don't need them. So by carrying guns, you create a higher level of complexity, and yet there's absolutely nothing that would validate the use or carrying of the firearm. So for example, we see more house fires than we do gunfire, 100 times more. But nobody wants to carry a fire extinguisher. Why is that? Because it's not sexy. So the whole reason for carrying the gun was not because you're gonna be in these shootouts, right? Which you, by the way, by thinking about shootouts, you can actually create shootouts. The real reason is because the real reason for carrying the gun was to make you feel better. It's a feeling, it's not a reality. If you really wanted to be safe, then you'd carry a fire extinguisher and a first aid kit because you're more likely to use both than you are a gun. But you will find 9 times out of 10 people that carry guns have no fire extinguisher close by, and even less of them have fire, have a first aid kit. And all people need a first aid kit for cut a finger, a ice pack. I mean, but yet how many people have first aid kits? Not even a priority for a lot of people. But the reality is a first aid kit is way more appropriate to have even on your person than a pistol. You're way more likely to need that. And so when you think about, you know, how we think about safety, it's really backwards. Remember, every dead police officer had at least two guns at the time of their death. So, you know, and I say this to civilians all the time, people, the public, what would make you better at surviving than any dead police officer? What class did you take that the officer didn't take? I mean, what would make you think that this officer carries two guns and nine times out of 10 knew he was going to be in a possibly, at least possibly knew he was going to be in a gun conflict when he had the gun conflict and died in the line of duty with his guns on? Most likely, in most conditions, they had their gun in their hand. And that is, you know, a fantasy that somehow if I have my gun, I will survive. And that's not true. You can shoot thieves that have no intent. Oh, every day. It's very easy. But remember, 99% of all thieves do not shoot people. It's very rare that a robber shoots someone. It's also very rare that a murderer takes time to go around and start thieving. Those are two separate things, except in our mind. So in real life, when someone kills someone, the first thing they think is a hit. They don't think it's a robbery. And that's because robbers very rarely ever kill the people that they're robbing. So when you hear about it, remember that for every time you hear about someone getting killed in a robbery, 1,000 other people got robbed with no, you know, no injury whatsoever. So it's just very rare that an actual robber is also a murderer.
So I think that is that's very much related to another common question we get, or comment, is that it's that a seastead community will never be safe from invasion until they have a nuclear weapon. And so that's a nuclear weapon equals a gun in that scenario.
Yeah, that's insane. that's literally a ludicrous concept, conceptual thinking. So, for example, if you have some type of doomsday device in a isolated community on water, what would happen is someone would set it off to destroy the community. Remember, the collateral damage is zero. So the only reason you don't do that is because of collateral issue. You're not going to have collateral issue if everybody in the community is going to be destroyed by this device. So there's no way that anyone would care. So the reason why you don't, for example, invade Iraq, the reason why you do invade Iraq is because they can't defend themselves with any ability that could destroy the oil that's there. So we invade it. The reason why you can't invade somewhere like Russia or any other major real country, even Iran will never invade there, is because Iran has the ability to destroy the functionality of the area, whether it's biological, chemical, using the weapons we already sold them years ago, or nuclear weapons. It really wouldn't matter either way. We can't go in there and do anything because there's no benefit. So the idea that, you know, having a device that would somehow blow up is just not necessary, especially in that case. I mean, if you're in the ocean, all you have to do if you wanted to scuttle the situation, you scuttle them, you drop them in the water, and now there's no pods. And so there's no benefit for them except that they may have been after you. And if they were after you, then, you know, either way, they win, right? They win by, you know, you destroying yourself or you destroying them or you destroying their own pods. So that's why it's imperative not to be in an adversarial condition in the first place. So once you're in an adversarial condition, there's going to be a problem. So what we do first in a community situation is you make sure that there's multiple winners. So in the event that there was some type of group in the area that's a gang or some type of militia, some type of organized crime syndicate, we would contact them and ask them for protection of the region around the pods. And what they would do is keep the other pirates away in exchange for a financial deal. And so what you want is you want multiple layers of protection. And that's in every community that you have. So you never want to be dependent on any one thing. So in our case, in a pod case where you're in someone's territory, where people can still have access to. You're not in Antarctica. You would want to make sure the people that are most likely to benefit from your demise are benefiting from your benefit. So you must create multiple levels of benefit for everyone involved and make sure that there's multiple losers in the event that you lose.
But what if having that crime syndicate to be your protector, what if that violates the law of your nearest, you know, land-based government? So we talked earlier about making sure that everything you do is legal legal everywhere.
As legal as you can.
Okay.
Let me be clear. You remain as legal as possible. You want to create as much, you know, you want to decrease your likelihood of inconvenience and stress. And that means you just do things the easiest way possible. However, in a situation where, you know, obviously, you know, the situation's gray, it is what it is. And so, you know, essentially what the community is doing is setting up in the gray area. It is saying, you know, we want to create our own societal structure here, separate from others, with our own core values that we find valuable. We're doing our own community. We don't need your permission. We don't need your input. However, we don't want conflict with you. And that's where threat management concepts come into play. You know, how do you create this without creating conflict? And that's a problem for every community, right? The reason why there's in the south of France, absolutely no one alive that believes John the Baptist is the son of Jesus, is the son of God, is because they were all killed by those that didn't believe that. So that was what believers did in something when they believed in something. And that's not, you know, far from today. When people believe something, they act on it. We want to make sure they believe that the pod community, the Seasteaders, are not their adversaries and they're not good people to be in conflict with, but there's also nothing to be in conflict about. In fact, we'll win with together. And here's how we negotiate that. So we would look at how we can benefit them directly.
Sure.
And that's key. That's what I was saying about Thailand, is that we needed to, and I said this to Joe Quirk many years ago, we need to look at ways of communicating with locals in the area and making sure that we have locals that have buy-in. So the reason why my organization is successful in Detroit is because I make everyone a winner. I make the poor people that live there safe. I protect them. They have no money. And as a result of them not getting killed, they have no money to pay for services. As a result of poor people and working class people being safe, the rich people who own the buildings they live in, renting homes and renting apartments, those people now have more renters. Those rich people now are richer. So they're winning. So now both the poor and working class people are winning, because they have a safe place to live. The rich people that own their properties have more occupancy, much more occupancy, so they're a lot wealthier. They're happy. The businesses in the area are now thriving because they have more customers, so they're happy. The police have little to no crime in the area, so it looks like without any resource change, without any expenditure of time, energy, or money on the police department's part, their crime rate went away. Their complaints went away in this area. So they're a winner politically. And then there's police officers live in the area. They're winning. So everyone's a winner. So in the case, one example of what you can do in the seasteading community is you can have, you know, and automatically you have one pod that's for your protection. You have one pod that's for visitors and dignitaries, right? Visitors and collaborators and people that are, you know, just check it out, or renting pod. That would be one that you would give to for usage for, you know, local police, politicians, marina owners, business owners that are in the area as a bonus for supporting the seasteading community. They get to use it once a month.
Okay.
So now if someone were to attack this pod community in any way, politically or otherwise, the police, the politicians, the mayor, the marina owner, the business owners in the area are going to lose customers, supporters, and the use of a pod once a month.
Sure. Yeah, that makes sense.
So you create more and more winners, and then you have less people that want you to lose. And if we're, in fact, they'll defend you because they don't want to lose.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about what could threaten individuals within a community. So we've talked about what could threaten the community from outside. What are some of the things that we should be concerned about or look for when we're inviting people to join a CSTN community, or if we're living in a CSTN community, what are some of the most threats that you think would be the most common?
So one of the things you want to do is interview the entire family and talk to them and do it under the guise of, you know, we want to introduce you to it, you know, come out, come visit. You want to give them a visit tour first. You know, that's where you have this one pod where they come check it out first. And what you're actually doing is assessing them and how they treat each other, because you don't want a volatile family in your community. Not to say people, you know, have to be perfect, but you just don't want people that are clearly not getting along, screaming, yelling, beating children, or, you know, children that are out of control. you want to be careful about who you let into your community. One bad person in the community can ruin everything. You want to be very specific about your rules and what happens in the event of breach of those rules. So there needs to be different levels. So for example, level one violation, you know, $100 fine. Level two violation, $200. Level three violation, $300. You know, level 10 violation is removal from access from the community completely. And that's where, you know, it's a process where the community comes together. Council of all the pod members would, you know, decide together if this is appropriate or not and what's appropriate. But it's based on the rules, not based on feelings of the group. So it's not democracy deciding on the fly if they like you or not. It's the rules being determined if they're applicable or not. And it's very important that you have those established rules and they're enforced by everyone towards everyone. And then you want to be very specific about that up front, because what you want is a quality of life that's good for everyone there. So you want to be specific. If you want to say, well, you can party as long as there's, you know, not above this sound level, you know, you kind of look at, see how much, how many decibels of music, you know, does it take to interfere in the quality of life of the pods, of your pods? Are the pods facing inwards? Are they facing outward? Do you have a choice of the angle of your pod? Can you soundproof your pods? So all these things have to be discovered as well. And then, you know, what kinds of remedy do you have? So some of the remedy are, you know, legal, where you meet and you know, hopefully you don't have to get other people involved. But that's where you have to have structure and able to enforce whatever your rules are. So, you know, one of the things to do is to maintain the pods as a community, and then have people, you know, have condominium type control, so that in the event that a person isn't taking care of their pod, it wouldn't, you know, go into the water, go underwater, because it's actually being maintained by the association. Which would also be very beneficial, since, you know, if I'm just flying down for the weekend with my family to enjoy myself, I may not be a, you know, a podologist and want to study on which pod company to use, or which, you know, what, you know, how to maintain this thing as a whole new venture. I'm a boat owner and we use boats here in our marinas. We protect marinas here in Detroit. And there are many marinas here in Detroit, by the way. There are more boat owners in Detroit and more luxury boat owners in Detroit in Michigan than there is in any other state in the United States. Did you know that?
No.
Michigan has the highest number of licensed boats in the United States. There's no state.
Well, we need some Michigan ambassadors then.
Yeah. And so our boats are, you know, it's part of our culture here. There's five marinas that are inner city marinas, just all inner city people. Beautiful luxury boats, Sunseekers, and this is one of the there's communities here on the water. They have waterways to the back of their homes, beautiful homes, $1 million homes that are incredible. Looks like something you'd see in Florida, and but they're right here in Michigan, frozen water right now. So we use boats to protect our marinas and protect our marina residents, and we also go and rescue them if need be. So we literally pull our residents back to the marinas from wherever their vessel may have gone down using our vessel. So we would definitely have, in history of understanding how on the water conduct and safety is also managed from our marina activities, because we have to manage people, parties, people living on boats. That's something we do every day, you know, for 6 months of the year, is manage people living in their boats on the water and how they get along with other people. And in some cases, there are fights. There are situations involving firearms, with legal firearms, CPL holders, you know, people with concealed pistol licenses. There are people not getting along. There's all these structured, concepts. Where I got these ideas from is from actually having boots on the ground and having to deal with these issues, male, female, old, young, you know, different types of issues, and wealthy people, working class people, and seeing, you know, what's the best remedy for how to deal with these situations. And what I found is the best thing to do is to make sure that you have, first of all, pre-selected people that are the kinds of people that could get along in this kind of community and be weary of certain types of personality types. It's not based on, your religion, your ethnicity, your age, your sex, gender. None of those things matter. What matters is a personality type. There are certain personality types that are able to be congenial and get along with others, and there's others that are not. And so we will go into, you know, how you determine those things and what are the key features, and then how you do a reference check to make sure that they're the kind of people you want.
Wait, but aren't there scammers who are very genial, or like narcissists, or like abusive personalities that they come across as very charismatic and genial, but then
that's why you need threat management. That's what we do.
Sure.
Yeah. You couldn't do it on your own. You're seriously, it's like anything else. Managing human threat is like anything else, but way more complex. The difference between managing human threat and managing, threats to humans medically is that, there's no actual, enemy that is, or nemesis that is, has a thought process for a surgeon. But when you're dealing with humans, and managing the threat potential of humans, you're dealing with the Earth's apex predator. And in order to do that, you must understand them, and you must understand multiple levels of them and their perspectives, which is not yours. And one of our major issues as people is that we typically look at other people as though they are ourselves. And that's mistake number one. So we tend to see, like, if you're a con artist, you think everyone's a con artist. If you're a person who's not a con artist, you think no one is. If you're a good person, you might think other people are good people. If you're evil, you don't trust people and you think other people are evil. And so what I found through the years is that I had to learn how to ignore the normal human behaviors that we all have. And that means me. And I had to relearn how I understand humans. And if I didn't, my employees would have killed me. My clients would have bankrupted me. And the criminals would have murdered myself and my staff. So I had to develop a higher level of understanding in order to survive. And that's what I bring to the table, is how I made those adjustments from middle class. I grew up in Ann Arbor, Michigan, which is where the University of Michigan is. And it's a college town, a very progressive town. And I looked at the world through that lens. I looked at it as everyone's intelligent. Everyone is, you know, down to earth and professional and, you know, just generally good people. And I did not know that you need to pay attention to people and you need to determine who they are based on their behaviors, not on your personal lens. And so that's why I developed threat management. And that's where I learned psychology and I added psychology to our training, because I thought all people needed was the physical aspects of training, fighting, standing up, fighting on the ground, fighting multiple aggressors, fighting with a baton, a bat, a knife, a pistol, a shotgun, a rifle. I thought if you knew that and then knew the law, you were perfect. And then so you knew civil law and criminal law. So at least, you know, you're making the best decision for yourself, your family, your community, and your corporation when you use a pistol, a shotgun, a rifle, a knife, your vehicle as a weapon, your dog as a weapon, your hands, your feet. I thought that if you just knew these physical things and looking at the law as though it was physical, that you could, you know, you'd be okay. You know, you'd be able to manage your threats. That's not true. What happens is you'd be able to survive not consistently. And the reason why is because what we all have to understand is that humans, our behavior is compulsive. It's based on subconscious behaviors. So although we might consciously say, I want to be on a diet, subconsciously, I cannot complete that task if I don't deal with my subconscious issues. I may not want to be mean to people, but subconsciously, I'm going to mistreat people because I'm not dealing with my subconscious issues. I'm not even aware that my compulsive nature is to be disrespectful. So I disrespect people. You know, whatever my issues are as a person, whatever our issues are as human beings, we have to become introspective just to understand ourselves. And most people don't have the intellectual capacity to do that. They don't want to. They don't want to learn about themselves. So if we don't know about ourselves, we can't possibly understand other people is the big point. And that's where management comes in. We're going to arm people with a higher level of understanding of human behavior and understanding praxeology. We call it protective praxeology and protective proxemics. You know, what does it mean and how do you defend yourself in close quarters? But how do you use psychology developed over a 20-year period where I learned that my old way of thinking from being an airborne paratrooper, being a martial artist all my life, and being a firearms instructor, NRA certified firearms instructor of 5 disciplines, I learned that my whole way of thinking was wrong. Everything I thought was wrong. My violence, my predisposition for what I call righteous violence was wrong. I truly believed that if someone did something, they deserved to be punished. and that's what I thought of life. I thought of it as black and white, right and wrong. And I was completely wrong. Number one, people make mistakes. Number two, you see things wrong often. You see things from your perspective, and it's just not that way. It's just a misunderstanding. And number three, even though you can hurt somebody, it's best if you treat people like family. It's best if you look at people as family, and that'll help you to understand how best to treat someone under all conditions. And really, the key is love of humanity in order to protect humanity. And so genuinely, if we don't like people and we don't love people, there's no way that we can actually help and protect them properly. That's the big message and big picture.
All right. Well, I would feel a lot more confident living in a seasteading community, knowing you'd given it a seal of approval and had some processes set into place there.
Absolutely. We're looking forward to it. We know it can be, I believe this can be very successful. I believe this is a great idea. I believe this is a really, really good idea on a much larger scale. I believe this is a great beginning concept, but I believe this could be a solution in the future for societal issues on a massive scale. And the reason why is because there needs to be options and opportunities for people that wish to separate from, more violent and vile conditions. And, you know, I look forward to contributing to help make that happen. And I know it's possible. I know with the right kinds of people that are focused on having a peaceful, successful society, I know it could be done. It doesn't have to be inappropriate in any way. It doesn't have to be religious or based on some type of political groups or some type of ethnic or gender issues. None of those things are needed or necessary. You can create a successful environment by looking at people as people and creating conditions to deny the opportunity for negatives to occur by design. And that's really what threat management is about. Preventive threat management is what we call it. And it prevents the opportunity for negative occurrences to, occur by design.
Yeah. So let's wrap up the conversation and please share with Seasteaders on the programs that you offer at the Threat Management Center and the classes that they can take and how they can learn the methods that you teach.
Yes. So we are opening franchises in different states, different cities, different countries. We have lots of people around the world that have been responding and looking forward to opening their own franchise. Our objective is to bring a threat management center that teaches urban survival tactics to your community. And specifically what we teach is psychology, law, and skill in that order. By teaching tactical psychology, you understand both civil and criminal law. Tactical psychology, you understand how to understand human behavior and how to create non-adversarial interactions for nonviolent outcomes by understanding psychology and how humans think and being ahead of their decision-making. So you don't wait for them to do something. You also don't have fear of them, and you learn how to manage them psychologically. And then legally, you understand what you can and cannot do or how you can do things legally and how to avoid as much negative civil and criminal outcomes as possible and how to manage them best. And then tactically, how to escape, control, or immobilize threat within 3 moves or less. So we don't teach a fighting system, we teach a survival system. It's how to stop fights. So it's literally how to anti-fight. And again, we've used this in Detroit on gang members. So we're talking about people that tried to kill us. We're not talking about a guy trying to steal, you know, something from a store. We're talking about actual gangs, the numerically superior. I have males and females. I've had over 2,500 team members since 1995 fighting force on force conflict with actual violent people. Again, not people breaking laws or rules, but violent people. So we don't specialize in criminal related activities or dealing with, you know, theft or something. We deal with actual violent gangs that want to hurt, to rape, rob, and kill people. And instead of letting it happen and looking for evidence, what we're known for is force on force conflict with those groups and individuals, stopping them from doing it. And so that's where we got our experience from, was real world application, putting our hands and our boots and our weapons into play against violent people and doing so legally. So we've had no court dates in 25 years. We've had no, none of our staff members have been killed in 25 years. 6 of our staff members have been shot, 1 female, 5 men, and all of them are alive and well today because we stabilized our wounded and transported them to level 1 trauma hospitals. And we gave first aid to our staff members, trauma first aid on site, which is what we teach as well. And then, you know, none of us have any court dates, no lawsuits. And most importantly, no one that's come to us for help has been killed after coming and seeking us for assistance, whether they are free or paid clients. We do a lot of free work for domestic violence victims, stalking victims, and crime witnesses. These are regular people that can't afford us. We protect them anyway. If they have someone that's going to kill them, we keep them alive and we do it for free. We've been doing that for 25 years. We've easily given away $1 million in free services just to keep people alive. Someone's sister, someone's daughter, someone's mother, grandmother, and in some cases, entire families, both gay males and straight people. We've protected everyone from every kind of threat, Muslim, Christian, atheist, doesn't matter, Republicans, libertarians, we don't care much. What your Democrats, we don't care what your political group is. We keep you alive and safe. We work with police whenever possible, and police have prosecuted people that committed crimes, and we detain them. You know, the people that maybe have home invaded, stabbed people, things like that. And we specialize in not letting people home invade and not letting them stab people. So that's why we don't have a lot of contact with prosecution. Because our objective is to not let people do something to get prosecuted, which works great in the pod Seastead community. Your objective is to not have any negative repercussions. So our objective is to teach you how to understand psychology, how to use you know, your understanding of human behavior to determine whether or not this person's a threat. You'll be able to read their body language. You'll also be able to de-escalate them. You'll learn how to use your body language, micro expression, face expressions, head position, into to de-escalate them. To show them that you are not a threat to them, but to also simultaneously let them know you cannot dominate me. So there's a way to do that and how you project strength without projecting that you are an adversary. You show power and strength and positivity all at the same time. And that's how you create a bridge for this would-be violent person, whether it's mentally ill people or an actual violent criminal, to leave your presence and leave your family, leave your community without injuring or killing them. And without them injuring or killing you. And then also with that corresponds, your training corresponds with all that. You learn knife disarms, gun disarms. You learn knife tactics, gun tactics. Because even though you may not have a gun, criminals have them. So you need to have knowledge about how to defend yourself with all types of weapons. And we teach all that in our courses. So you get all that information. You get it quickly. You get it in a very practical format. And it's, again, urban survival tactics to make you your own bodyguard so you don't have to outsource your own protection. You take responsibility for your protection and you are essentially able to protect yourself and your family as your own bodyguard. And we're there to support you as well.
You do such wonderful work. And, you know, I say that seasteading is the next phase of human civilization. And I want to see that next phase with nonviolence as well. So, yeah. And what is your website and where can they find you on social media?
Our website is threatmanagementcenter.com. That's threatmanagementcenter.com. And you can also see us on YouTube, Detroit Threat Management Center, Vipers, if you put those in, or Vipers, Detroit Threat Management Center, media. You can see a lot of our media coverage. We've had a lot of international and national media coverage over the years, a lot of our free programs. You can also see on our website testimonials from police officers that have used the training to protect themselves, protect members of the public, and what we're most proud of, there are police officers that testified on video. They used our training to not injure people in a situation where without our training, they would have normally. So these are situations where they're being attacked or someone's being attacked, and they choose to use our training to preserve life and create a nonviolent outcome. And we even have
more
civilians doing the same thing. So there's civilians on there giving testimonials. You can go to YouTube. You can also look on Facebook, Vipers Threat Management, Detroit Threat Management Center. Those are both two different Facebooks. And then Instagram, Threat Managers, Detroit Threat Managers, or Detroit Threat Management Center on Instagram.
That's great. So thank you again for coming on the podcast. And I'm sure we'll be working together to build the next seasteading community.
Absolutely. Looking forward to it.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you.
The Seasteading Today podcast is produced by John Bush. Your host is Carly Jackson. Send feedback and questions to podcast@seasteading.org. To support the podcast and the Seasteading mission, go to seasteading.org/donate. If you'd like to learn more, read the book, Seasteading: How Floating Nations Will Restore the Environment, Enrich the Poor, Cure the Sick, and Liberate Humanity from Politicians. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast feed, and we'll save you a spot on a seastead.